This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech at friendsintech.com.
Good morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video. Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts to disregard all safety rules. Here your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
Welcome to another special episode of Technorama. I'm your host, Chuck Tomasi. Normally, Technorama is the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. This time, however, I'm taking a serious talk with Bob Lettenberger from the National Railroad Museum in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Well, thank you for joining me today, Bob.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
It's a treat to see you again.
Yes.
Bob, the railroads used to be considered state-of-the-art, and back in the heyday of the steam engines and whatnot, when automobiles came along, they seemed to have faded into the background a bit, and I have you here to help the listener and me understand the tech of railroads. First of all, who is Bob, and why should we be listening to you for the next 40-odd minutes?
Well, I'm the operations manager from the National Railroad Museum in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Our museum, actually, we're celebrating our 50th anniversary this year. Among the railroad museums in our country, we are one of the larger ones, probably put us in about the top 20 to 25. Our collection is about 70 pieces of rolling stock and easily 50 to 100,000 plus other objects and items that span railroad history from the late 1800s literally to contemporary transportation in some cases. Really a great place to immerse yourself in what was transportation in our country, as you kind of alluded mm-hmm. to, sort of a heyday looking back at the 20s, 30s, 40s, even into the 50s, and something I'm sure we'll get into, kind of that demise that railroads took between the 60s and the 80s.
Now, how long have you been into railroading? Is it one of those kid interests where you got your first Lionel train and you were bitten?
Sort of so. I've always been interested in railroading, and especially its history. I mean, railroads really built our country. I've been with the museum professionally for 7 years. My background is communications, which is I do things like we're doing here today, mm-hmm. and a lot of our interpretive work, really explaining to folks things about the collection, doing things like this where we get to talk about some of the technology, not only from a historic standpoint, but in a lot of cases what's going on out there today, and really try to be a resource for folks as far as getting in touch with railroads and history and aspects of it.
Now, let's back up a bit. How far back can you date the quote-unquote modern railroad?
Well, in our country, the credit for really the first railroad, per se, goes to the Baltimore and Ohio, and that dates to the mid to late 1820s.
Wow.
In our country, rails with a flanged wheel and a vehicle date really to about the 1790s, very rudimentary. If you want to look at kind of what everyone pictures and thinks of as railroads today, really the heyday of the steam era, and then the coming of diesels, you're looking really at, say, about 1910, 1920, on up through World War II, and then in that era, say, late 30s, overlapping the end of steam into the 50s, 60s, and of course today, then we start looking at diesel power.
Now, it's all about freight today, moving. I mean, a lot of people think of the glory days of passengers. Are there still passenger lines out there?
Oh, sure. Plenty of passengers. I mean, Amtrak is still running in our country, and there is a somewhat of a surgence or a resurgence to look at, especially in the metropolitan areas, commuter rail. In Chicago, New York, L.A., Dallas, even Albuquerque, New Mexico now is working on a commuter rail system. So the Passenger is still out there, and I think you will probably see more Passenger as time goes on. But if you look at the big six railroads that are left in our country, freight is it. It really is.
Now let's talk about freight. Obviously, the more you move, the more money you're going to make.
The name of the game is that efficiency that on a train, you know, you can couple together 100 cars, 120 cars, load them with X commodities, and have a crew of two people move that over the line. The greater efficiency comes if you have a single commodity moved from an origin to a destination in the same train, and you cycle that around and around and around. And a prime example of that, right now in our country, a good number of electric utilities are getting their coal from the Powder River Basin in Wyoming. Between the Union Pacific Railroad and now BNSF Railway, those two, every single day by the dozen, are bringing coal trains out of the Powder River Basin, trains that are 100 to 120 cars in length. They are taking them from the mine directly to a power plant, emptying them out, and sending them back for another load.
They don't have three cars of Louisiana Pacific plywood and three cars of Walmart t-shirts.
Okay. No, it is just straight coal. And when you talk about now, like you had just referenced, you know, the mixed merchandise train, those still exist. They are a little bit on the downcline. And let's face it, you know, trucks have really eaten into some of that business. But when you look at commodity sort of things, coal, containers, freight traffic that is coming in at a port on the West Coast and going to the East, or coming in the East and going West, coming to the Middle West, auto parts, automobiles, and now again somewhat of a resurgence in perishable goods, especially fruit and vegetables coming from California or either Florida. Large blocks or entire trains run on a schedule and just keep cycling them right on through.
That's where the money is.
Yep. And it goes to things like a better on-time delivery system for the railroads, better usage of equipment, which then equates to, you know, fuel efficiency and better usage of manpower and everything that you can extrapolate from that. So, yeah, railroading is, when you look at moving large tons of freight, it's still there. It's still the way to go.
Well, let's take a look at the engine, because we'll start from the front and we'll work our way back. Sure. The engine is where probably the majority of the tech is, and a lot of these listeners are techno geeks. It's not the old, when we were at the Railroad Museum in May, we saw the big boy, valves all over the place, firebox, I mean, hot and humid and sticky, and it looked like a break your back job to keep that thing on the rails. Different today?
Incredibly different. Phenomenally different. Let's use the big boy as a comparison. There were 25 big boys built. They were built in the period of 1940 to 1944. The locomotive we're talking about has been dubbed as the world's largest steam locomotive. And you're looking at a unit that, when fully loaded and ready to go to work, weighs 1.18 million pounds.
I can't even fathom that.
It's huge. I mean, just incredible. Carries along 24,000 gallons of water to be boiled into steam and 32 tons of coal to build the fire to heat and boil that water. That unit, measuring 132 feet 9 7/8 inches long, standing 16 feet 3 inches high, and to give you a perspective, 132 feet 9 7/8 inches, it's about 45 yards on a football field.
Wow.
That unit will develop 6,000 horsepower, over 6,000 horsepower at about 40, 45 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. 1940, 41. Let's go to today. Today you have locomotives out there, diesels that are weighing in 900,000 million pounds. Horsepower in the 4,300 to 6,000 horsepower range. The big difference is the efficiency, the maintenance, and really the conditions that people are working in. Now, by efficiency, on a good day, the big boy as just a basically a great big boiler on wheels. Mm-hmm. Thermal efficiency, you know, on a really good day, boy, you might top out at 10-12%. You know, the furnace in your studio here is probably chugging away in the winter months at 94-96%.
Right. Okay. Right.
So you can see, you know, back in the steam era, most of that energy is literally being dissipated out into the environment. Today, you have literally high-tech diesel engines, and we're talking big. We're talking 12, 14, 16 cylinder in some cases, displacement per cylinder of, you know, 500-600 cubic inches.
Oh my.
Per cylinder. I mean, we're, you know, mop buckets.
They're big.
Yes, you know, mop buckets. And we're looking at some of the same controls that are being used to help automobiles, and I'm kind of stretching that a little bit, but I mean high-tech fuel injection, computers controlling you know, the heating, the cooling, so on and so forth. The other big thing is maintenance. You know, the big boy every month, every few thousand miles, had to go in, have the boiler drained, emptied, and have all of the flues, the pipes that mm-hmm. carry the heat and exhaust down the boiler, had to have them removed and replaced.
Sounds expensive.
Incredibly. And labor-intensive. I mean, you're talking about taking a locomotive out of service for literally days, if not a week or more. The other thing with a big boy, in any steam locomotive, they had to have the tires replaced. And yes, we're talking steel tires, steel wheels, take them off, regrind the flanges, you know, the whole nine yards. Again, very labor intensive. You're taking a unit out of service. Diesel locomotives today, I mean, some of the railroads, all the railroads really, in a lot of cases, some of these locomotives are running 24/7. You know, yes, they go down for maintenance, for checks, and so on and so forth, and you know, occasionally there are overhauls, but they're not the mammoth scheduled tasks that you had with steam locomotives.
This is Adam Savage from MythBusters, and you're listening to Technorama with Chuck and Craig.
The other thing, let's look at the comfort involved. When you visit the National Air Museum, we were looking at the cab of the big boy.
Yeah.
The noise in there would have been incredible. I mean, deafening. The heat. Normal temperature in a cab of a big boy was 80 to 90 degrees, and that's all year round. You know, going through a tunnel, you're going to jump up to 120 degrees, and then, Lord forbid, you stall out in a tunnel, the temperature can get up to 180 degrees.
Wow. No, so that, OSHA back
no,
then.
No, I mean, there is a gentleman's office environment. That's somebody's office environment for 10, 12 hours a day.
Yeah.
Okay, now let's look at today. The railroads have realized that there is, that basically an engineer and a conductor now sitting in the cab of a locomotive, that's their office. That's where they're going to conduct their business for, you know, 10 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
And coming through the 60s and 70s, and it really was realized in the 80s, you know, there is such thing as crew fatigue. You know, when you get into a train and there's certain vibrations that will kind of tend you to lull you nicely to sleep. Oh, God, we don't want that happening out, you know, with an engineer. And today's high-tech cabs and locomotive, you know, are shock mounted, so the vibrations are reduced. You have air suspension seats for the crews to sit in. There are restrooms in virtually all of them. Some have refrigerators, some have microwaves, hot plates for, you know, for coffee. You know, there's the creature comforts, heating, air conditioning, of course. But then when you look at the tech for operation, a lot of the high-tech ones today essentially have a black box that is very similar to what you see on airlines. Now, it's not necessarily recording communication, but what it's looking at is train speed,
mm-hmm.
Whistle signals. Was the proper whistle signal given based on where you are on the track? Looking for grade crossing incidents. How was the engine performing? You know, were the wheels slipping? You know, was this part working properly? So on and so forth. They're going to look at all those things and record them. even some of the highest tech locomotives today, you know, we talked about grade crossing incidents. I mean, literally crashes at crossings. Some of the locomotives today, just like squad cars for police, have a camera mounted in the windshield to record a trip, which is then synced up with that black box, and you can really check performance and safety issues.
Speaking of safety, I think I've seen some of those shows on television where you see the camera mounted in the cab, and they hit the car. I mean, somebody was crossing the crossing illegally.
Yep.
And let's talk about safety for a bit.
You know, if you look at it, and we can compare and contrast again, back in the time of the Big Boy in the 1940s, you're looking at a steam locomotive like the Big Boy, where from where the engineer is seated to the front of the unit is about 65 feet. Wow. And so that engineer, you know, back in the 1940s here, is looking about a quarter to half a mile down the track. Traveling along at 50 miles an hour, which the Big Boy was capable of doing, and having a train behind them of, say, 3,000 or 4,000 tons, from the time that that engineer hits the brake until they stop is a half mile or a mile.
Mm-hmm.
And your engineer is already looking a quarter to a half a mile down the track.
He wouldn't even see anybody if he hit them.
Exactly. Exactly. That's, you know, that's 1940s. Now let's look at today. Today's cabs, comfort cab, engineer up front, of course, with sufficient protection out in front of them, but has an incredible view of the track and the surrounding environment that they're traveling through. Trains today, the coal train we were talking about earlier that, you know, could be weighing anywhere from 10 to 12,000 tons.
Mm-hmm.
Traveling at 50 miles an hour today, from the time they hit that brake initially to the time they stop, is going to be somewhere around a mile. And quite literally, if you're on the tracks or car or, you know, pedestrian, for, you know, Lord forbid, the engineer's really got about three things they can do. They throw the train into emergency brake, they lay on the horn, and call the dispatcher and tell them they're going to need emergency assistance. And that's about all they could do.
Because it's going to take them a mile to stop. Yep. And you know, who knows what's going to happen with, say, a car. Could go up, could go off, could both go under.
Have no idea where it's going to go. No idea. And when you think about it from the technical side, and this is, you know, it's a the results are a sad thing, but when you look at the physics and some of the things that are being done to help prevent this and the safety and whatever, there is an incredible amount of physical motion within a train. And when you see a train coupled together, there is a certain amount of play in between those cars.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You know, if everything is all pushed together, your train is going to be, you know, X distance in length. And, it all depends on a great number of factors. Start pulling on that train, and before you even get it moving, everything stretches out.
There's little gaps between the
exactly.
lengths. And,
exactly. Yep. You know, couple of, you know, say feet, but inches of play. We'll add mm-hmm. that up over 100 cars, and there's quite a bit of slack action in there. And when you hit those brakes in an emergency situation, all that comes piling down on top of the locomotive. So it's not only that, you know, you have the speed, but now you also have that forward momentum that is still pushing you along, which makes that stopping distance so critical.
I've heard that sound. I used to live in Marquette, Michigan, where there are a couple of ore docks, and it was an impressive sound when they would finally stop the train and you would hear all those gaps close up.
Yep.
It was like firecrackers going down the line.
Yep.
That was a neat sound.
Exactly. And it's it. And I tell you, from the other standpoint, you know, slack action, if you ride a passenger train, and today there's things like tight lock couplers that really try to reduce that gap and that slack action, and there's extra springing on a passenger train, but you can always tell if you got a really good engineer, boy, if you take off and you don't feel that and you just start gliding down the tracks. And I will tell you that my engineering skills at the museum aren't quite there yet. So if you get caught with me as an engineer, you're going to feel a little slack action.
Well, let's talk about the physics of, we mentioned going up a hill. Most people think, you know, it takes a lot of energy to get that sucker up the hill. And, you know, we've all heard the story about the runaway train coming down the hill. But there's subtleties and more to it than that.
Tr- train handling is really a skill, and I would say an art if we were talking, say, 10, 15, 20 years ago, but now it's becoming very much a scientific skill with some of the training the railroads have out there. Think about this. You start up a hill, and Chuck, you're exactly right. You're going up that hill. You've got that throttle wide open, or in locomotive parlance, if you will, locomotive throttles come in eight notches, eight speed steps.
Mm-hmm.
One being the lowest, eight being the highest. So when you're going full out, you're in notch eight. you're giving her it for all she's worth. And climbing up a hill, you have everything strung out behind you. Your locomotives are going full bore. And as you get to the top of that hill and start going down, the engineer really has a very delicate juggling game they need to engage in. They still need to pull a portion of that train up the hill, but yet another portion of that train, the part that has already crested, is going to start pushing down on the locomotives. So the game to play is provide enough power to get the whole train over the hill, try to keep the slack action in control so that there's no sudden jerks that will pop a knuckle on a coupler, say that three times real fast, and separate the train. And it's a challenge. And when you look at what the railroads are doing today, with the aid of computers, they're taking their engine crews and putting them through some extensive simulator training. And in fact, a few years ago, I was in West Chicago, where the Union Pacific has an extensive training facility, and we were at the time we were looking at one of their older simulators that they had, and the program they had set up in it was one to show engineers how to handle their train on essentially an undulating profile, series of ups and downs, and the computer would then, you know, would take and would simulate a modern setup of locomotives and a you know, train of a specified size. And they had picked out a particular Union Pacific line through Missouri where the profile was really hills and valleys after hills and valleys. And instead of being out on the road with somebody's freight and all the danger involved in that, here you sat in a simulator and learned what was going to happen to your train. And it was an interesting experience to sit there as the complete historian and actual professional railroad rookie, if you will, not even rookie level, but to see how in just a simulator this was going to behave and watch the force and the action behind your locomotive in that train. Just incredible.
The closest analogy I can come to that is in golf. If you have to putt over a hill and try and make it stop at the hole, you need just enough energy to get over that hill and not fall back, but not too much so that you go shooting past the hole on the other side. It's a very delicate maneuver.
Exactly. Exactly, it is. And that kind of leads us into some other technology really on trains today. A lot of this technology has to do with braking within the train, and then use of throttle, and also monitoring things like wheel slip. Trains on a track and the locomotive can spin on the rail just like we do on ice with our cars.
Well, steel on steel. It doesn't sound like a lot of friction to me.
No. And a lot of the high-tech units now will have wheel slip monitors that will govern themselves and will begin to detect when a wheel is starting to slip and will make adjustments for it. The other things with braking, in our going back, I mean, all the way to the beginning development of brakes in our country when they were developed by Westinghouse, the idea with the brakes is that as you actuate them from the locomotive, the pressure is reduced in each train car down the train so that the brakes will apply.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's the original way of doing it. So in sequence, the first car on the train gets its brakes applied first. If it's a long train, you know, a few minutes later, the last car is finally getting its brakes applied.
So it's not concurrent. Everybody hits the skids at once.
Right.
Wow.
Okay, that's the original way. Now, move to the high-tech today and beyond. When you look at a hill situation or an undulating profile, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes it would be nice to have those brakes apply almost simultaneously or have them start braking from the front and the rear so that there's a quicker application. And there's technology out there now that is allowing a train and an engineer to do that so that you can have a better control of your train and its braking, and then also so that you don't have to put as much effort into the braking, whereas the cars in the front wear out their brake shoes faster and sure. the one, you know, okay. And it's all really a high-tech sort of a development that has come about in, say, the last 10 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a incredible safety thing when you look at it as far as controlling the train.
This is John Chatterton from Deep Sea Detectives. You're with Chuck and Craig on Technorama.
Now, you mentioned the in the old days, there was the caboose, and the brake man was in the back.
the old steam crew, you know, you look in the steam era, a freight train generally had a crew of five.
Mm-hmm.
An engineer, a fireman, a brakeman on the head end of the train, the conductor, and the rear brakeman in the caboose. And this even kind of predates air brakes, because then the method of stopping the train was that those two brakemen had to get out, walk along the roofs of each individual freight car, and set the brakes by hand.
Oh my.
Yeah, and this is while we were moving along. Yeah. Invention of the air brake cuts that down. The other thing with the caboose, and the caboose really was there for that rear brakeman for the conductor, but then they also had another purpose. And here's another interesting technological development, even going back to the 30s and 40s. Originally, the axles on freight cars or on any railroad car was the axle sitting in essentially a brass cradle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that cradle and the end of that axle came out in a journal box, which was filled with oil and a cotton waste rag, the idea that held the oil up against the wheels. Oil gets too low, heat builds up from friction, cotton rag, poof, burns up, and we have train flambé. Okay, and back in the time when you had a lot of wooden cars, very dangerous situation.
Oh, yeah.
So the caboose was set there so that the brakeman and the conductor could, as they're going around a curve, view the side of the train and check for hot boxes. Okay, we go into roller bearings. Mm-hmm. In the late 30s, 40s, and of course now today, equipment is required to have roller bearings. And you've taken away a major thing that rear brakeman and the conductor are looking for. All right. Air brakes come along. We further reduce the need for those folks back there. Contemporary radio communications come along where you have computers that can send two-way radio signals and mm-hmm. monitor things like air pressure in the train's brake pipe. Now, why do you have these two guys sitting back there at all? Why do you need the brakeman anymore?
Right.
And our train crew goes from five down to two, and that extra 40 tons of caboose that we're pulling along back there, gone. Bye-bye. Mid-1980s is really when the caboose exited American railroading. And what came in its place was an end-of-train device which monitored the air pressure and sent a signal back up to the cab when it dropped. And mm-hmm. it also would throw the train into a braking application. Today, that end of train device, besides just being a little blinking light back there, is doing a whole host of other things. It's monitoring where the rear end of the train is. You know, in case the train separates, kind of be nice to know where the rear end of the train is.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. The braking that we were talking about, actuating from both ends, that end of train device now today can actuate that. There's enough computer control that it will do that. And of course, it's still back there as that flashing safety device that the caboose always was, saying, hey, you know, here's the back end of my train. Yeah. So long way from the original caboose.
Oh, bad.
Incredibly long way.
Yeah. Now, one thing that's been jumping around in my mind, everybody's on the GPS thing these days. Everybody's got to have a satellite navigation. Trucks have a dome on them to tell you where they are, how long the guy's been driving, yada, 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 a host of information. Do trains have something similar?
Sure. GPS has been put to use in railroads in a number of different ways. Couple things. I think the Union Pacific Railroad, I think, is probably the leader in this right now, but I believe the vast majority of their road locomotives are GPS equipped, and they're basically doing what you would describe, just like the trucking companies are doing. I think one of the biggest ones involved in that is Schneider National, incredibly high tech with knowing exactly where their units are. Well, the Union Pacific has kind of gone that same route, but GPS in railroads has gone to a little bit of a higher degree, if you will. Imagine if you are traveling along on a train track, and it's a single track, and you own the railroad, and you want to get as much usage out of that track as you possibly can, which means running as many trains through as you can.
Yeah.
Well, as we've talked, you need to have a certain stopping distance for those trains, and take in account hills and valleys. You know, we need a certain distance for climbing for slower trains and so on and so forth. Other than line side signals, how are we going to keep those trains apart, separated? But yet you want to get them as close together as you safely possibly can. Well, the railroads have looked at something called positive train control. In fact, one of the big companies that has worked on developing this is Union Signal. Union Signal goes way back, 100 years back, to some of the original semaphore signals. And with GPS technology, through what now is, like I said, positive train control, you can have, instead of hard blocks, hard control points on a railroad, you can essentially go to a soft control point, in that you can run a series of trains, and through checking track conditions and GPS location, and then, of course, a lot of the things that the little black box and the locomotive is monitoring, and now with two-way communications is feeding back to the dispatcher, you can identify where the train is, where, not only where it is, but what are the track conditions that are coming up, what are the trains that are surrounding it. And so instead of saying, hey, we've got a block signal at mile 55 where it's a control point and we, you know, stop, start, slow down trains, speed them up, now that becomes soft. And at mile 55, instead of having a signal there going, whoa, stop here, the computers and the dispatchers are looking and saying through GPS and checking all the train parameters, hey, we can roll past milepost 55 here and have a train a mile or two out in front, a mile or two behind, another one a mile or two behind that, keep them all going at X speed, and then make adjustments along the way. So say if that train that's in the middle is larger and heavier, all right, maybe what we've got to do is look and say, well, we need to scoot him into a siding based on where he's, how he's performing, let that third train come by, and then get this other one back out there. So there, what it does is it allows a railroad to be incredibly fluid, safe distances between trains, which increases capacity and efficiency, and for us stockholders, makes a few more bucks. And it's all, you know, it's through computers and GPS, just, and it's all, you know, on board talking to dispatchers that can literally be thousands of miles from where something is happening.
It's, the trains of today are as different as, you know, a Model A from a Lexus. I
mean, absolutely.
It really has come a long way.
Night and day, just incredible, the technology that's out there. And you know, yet there still is a great mystique about railroads, because through it all, it's still a steel wheel on steel rails, and there's some of that nice clickety-clack sound, and at night you can still hear a train whistle go blow all over our country.
Yeah, about a quarter mile that way, when the window's open, lovely.
Exactly.
Actually, when I lived with my brother in a duplex a couple miles away, It was right next to a switching yard down on Perkins Street. They would come by in the middle of the night, screech!
You know, and Chuck, that kind of it's a funny, interesting point. You know, one of the big things toward the top of our chat here, we had talked about EPA standards for emissions from railroads.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you know, everyone thinks EPA, and they're going fuel conservation and particle emissions and cut down on the dioxins and so on and so forth. Okay, they're also looking at noise emissions.
Exactly what you're
describing. And one of the techno things that are in some of the new locomotives, especially ones that are being used in yard service, just like you're describing, is an automatic startup shutdown system. So that if they're not being used for a certain time, they can cut their idle or they can completely shut them down.
Really?
Yeah, and then you know, say maybe a half hour before shift starts, if a locomotive hasn't been used, it can automatically start itself up, build up its air pressure so that it's ready to go when the crew gets there, as opposed to sitting and idling all night or causing annoyance for the neighbors.
This is David Levy, amateur astronomer, lover of the night sky, and comet discoverer. You are listening to Chuck and Craig on Technorama.
Well, we talked about EPA. Mm-hmm. Originally, we had steam. Mm-hmm. Then we had diesel, which is predominant now. Is mm-hmm. it diesel electric?
Diesel electric.
And now we're going, where's the next step?
Next step is really something called, and it's really something that has come out in the last couple of years and is I want to say almost, I don't want to say quite wildfire proportions yet, but the roads are really snapping their heads around looking at this. There is something called a green goat.
That's a great name.
it's a green goat. In fact, I'm gonna grab my sheets here. It was pulled this off of their website to talk about it today. There's a company called Rail Power, and great website. You can go out and learn all about this. But they have a couple of different locomotives out there now that are totally green. And the first one they came out was something called their RP series, and it's a road switcher. It's really designed to do yard switching work.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of the traditional diesel electric scenario where you have a diesel engine that's anywhere from 1,000 to 3,000 horsepower, this locomotive has a very small diesel, and we're talking 500 horsepower.
Geez, I think your truck out, my driveway has more than that.
Exactly. And that, exactly right. And that, that diesel is running a small generator, and then most of the locomotive is a huge bank of batteries.
Hmm.
And they're charging the batteries and using that battery, that stored power. So you have a very fuel-efficient locomotive, you have a very quiet locomotive, and you have a locomotive that essentially, in a lot of ways, recycles itself. Batteries get old, put new batteries in, and away we go again. The other one that they're looking at is designed, you have the green goat for yard work. The other one they're looking at is basically that locomotive that will travel around a town or short distances to switch industries away from the yard. Typically, that type of locomotive would have been a single diesel engine, 900 to 3,500 horsepower,
mm-hmm.
so a fair-sized diesel. What they have done now is taken on a single frame and hooked in or set up three generators and three smaller diesel engines, again about 500 horsepower a piece. And what they have found then, with also some battery storage, that single 500 horse engine can generate enough power for certain tasks. If the onboard computer feels that more power is needed, it kicks in the second one. More power kicks in the third one. And then just the opposite. If you don't need it, shut them down. Draw power off either the one, two, or three that's running, plus some off the battery. That particular locomotive is said to reduce emissions particle emissions by about 80 to 90% over.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Over a typical unit. And it's also supposed to cut fuel consumption by 40 to 60%.
Which just means more money.
Yeah. It means a lot of things. Yes. More money for the stockholders, better profit for the railroad. Mm-hmm. But that's the tip of the iceberg. For you trying to catch sleep next to that train yard at 1 in the morning, it means a much quieter environment. For all of us, it means, you know, better fuel consumption, less reliance on oil, and it also means less garbage in the air that we're breathing.
Sure.
And when you look at a standard diesel locomotive, there are a lot of scenarios for efficiency, especially in winter because of weather conditions, that those are left to idle 24 hours a day.
Right.
Well, now think of it, a green goat with a little 500 horsepower engine, which may or may not be running depending on need, is cutting down on the noise and the fuel that it's burning and what it's spitting back out into the environment. Mm-hmm. It's a phenomenal leap forward, incredible leap forward.
So what are they waiting for?
Actually, a lot of the railroads are not waiting. In fact, again, in particular, I'll look at the Union Pacific and also BNSF. Union Pacific right now leads the country in orders for the green locomotives. In fact, they have one of their biggest freight yards out in Roseville, California. Mm-hmm. They're not quite exclusively green yet, but as they're coming in, they are really putting these locomotives to service out there, and they have basically taken Roseville and are trying to make it their green yard and look at all the things that come out of the yard as far as emissions and cut them down drastically. So it's a neat and interesting trend.
That'll be exciting to watch.
Oh yeah.
Now I've got to ask, what does it take to be a train engineer? I mean, if I wanted to walk out of this room today, what kind of schooling and how long would it take to get there?
There's a number of different avenues that you can look at. There are a number of educational institutions around the country that you can go to school and study to be an engineer and whatnot. The railroads all generally have their own training programs as well. And you would start out as a conductor or a brakeman. And
I thought you said they were gone.
Well, it is kind of, you know, conductor slash brakeman because, you know, just like in anybody's position, you get that nice new title, but that new title also comes with all kinds of extra little things that you got.
Other duties as needed.
Yes, exactly. You know, yeah, you might be the conductor now, but, you know, you're the guy also that, you know, if the load comes loose 50 cars back, you're hiking back to check and see what, you know, what went on. You'll generally have a number of years as a conductor slash brakeman. Mm-hmm. And the brakeman part also really comes in depending on where you're assigned based on seniority. You know, you may be on a yard job or a switch job where you're more so on the ground doing brakeman sort of things as we think of traditionally. You will go through quite a bit of training. A lot of testing on regulations and rules. And I mean, the railroad operating rule book, you know, we know what we go through for a driver's license.
Yeah.
Okay, and you'd know what you'd go through for a driver's license for a semi. Well, add a little bit more on to that. I mean, the railroads have very strict rules, just like are out on, you know, the highways and whatnot, but they're even more extensive.
Are they under is the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, involved with that?
They are involved with that from the standpoint of accidents and rulemaking as far as safety is concerned. The other regulatory agency really is the Federal Railroad Administration.
Ah, just like the airlines have the FAA to say, you must put this device on to be safe.
Right. We have railroads have the FRA.
Oh.
There has been for decades, literally going back into the I believe it's about the 1920s, there has been a uniform operating code, and there are certain rules that are standard from road to road to road to road. Then there are Then there are rules that will, when you get down to specific railroads, there'll be specific practices mm-hmm. and rules that they will have. And then you'll even get down to certain divisions or sections of track where there will be certain other rules that you have to follow. Just kind of like the speed limit, you know?
Sure.
Pick a, you know, if you've got a line that's out in the country with no industry sidings and the track is in good condition, you're probably going to have a fairly high speed limit for a freight yep. train. All right. Get into a town and a lot of crossings and so on, you're going to have a different speed limit, much slower. Also, just like on the highway where there's restrictions where certain vehicles, because of weight, can mm-hmm. go certain places, the railroads have the same thing. Okay.
Okay.
So, I mean, there's quite a bit of rule making and regulation you need to follow. And those standardized rules, you know, they're covering things. Rule G. Every railroader knows Rule G. No alcohol, no drugs, while on duty or within X number of hours of going on duty. You know, and there are standard rules like that apply across the board on railroads.
So how long till I get to be an engineer?
Rough time, and like I said, it varies on aptitude and training, whatever. You could be looking at 2 to 4 years.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Almost like a college degree.
In a lot of ways, yeah. In a lot of ways, yeah. And the railroads, just like the trucking industry, you know, some of the railroads are hiring folks right and left. I mean, as transportation grows, they need the people. I know at one point the Western Railroads, Union Pacific, BNSF, were looking to hire several hundred people for engine service every year.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a need out there, definitely a need.
Well, Bob, where can they find out more information about the National Railroad Museum and where you live?
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, the best place, and I think it's probably apropos for a podcast, is, hey, let's go out to the World Wide Web. The National Railroad Museum has a website, www.nationalrrmuseum.org. There, if you want to visit the museum, you can find out about our hours, our schedule, our admissions, train ride times, the whole thing. There's also information there about our collections, about our exhibits, about becoming a museum member, about special events. We also have links to railroad sites and to other railroad-related train information points. And a lot of things we've talked about here today, like if you want to go out and see what the Union Pacific is mm-hmm. doing, you should be able to get to them through our website. So that'd be the first place to start. Of course, we're in Green Bay, Wisconsin. If you go onto our website, there's a category called Visiting the Museum. For those who want to drive in from literally anywhere in the country or around the world for that matter, we have a service on there where type in the address you're coming from and we'll shoot you back a map that will show you exactly how to get to our front door.
Terrific. So, thank you very much for
welcome.
Stopping by, Bob.
Been a pleasure.
Honor having you.
All right, we'll see you at the museum again soon.
All righty. And thank you for listening to this special interview. If you'd like to find out more about the National Railroad Museum, go to nationalrrmuseum.org. You can also join Craig and me for a bit of geek fun twice a week, along with other interesting interviews on Technorama at chuckchat.com. This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech. You can find out more about them at friendsintech.com and join the discussion forums at forums.friendsintech.com. Thanks again for listening, and as always, a binary high five, 101, so long.